Morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be learning today on a fascinating topic, and the topic is the bones that we carry with us in our lives. There are many bones that we carry with us in our lives. But before we start, we're going to be just acknowledging those who are sponsoring today's very special shir. Firstly, to David and Naomi Kasowitz, who are sponsoring today's shir, Lila Nishmas, David's father, Mr. Gabe Kasowitz. This is the third yard site. Where's David? David's right over here. The third yard site of Gedalia Yitzchak ben Shmuel Yosef Olav Shalom, Papa Kaz. Very special person in our community. Very much a figure in our shul and also in the white shul, of course. To David's grandmother, Mrs. Sarah Kasowitz, Sarah Bas Gedalia, Olav Shalom, and her namesake, their namesakes should continue to bring light to the world. We also are learning Le'ilu Nishmas Aaron ben Yaakov Shalom, which is also Yud Shvat, the yahrzeit of Tibby Schwartz's father, Olav HaShalom, and he must be getting a tremendous amount of nachas from the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren as they continue to spread Torah. Also want to thank the Horowitzes, Elliot and Shanzi, who are sponsoring the Le'ilu Nishmas, Mr. Harry Horowitz Yosef Tzvi ben Harav Pesach Halevi, upon his 28th yahrzeit, which will be just was, God willing, Nishmosai Aiden, he should have continued Aliyas Neshama from all the incredible activity of his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. We are learning a fascinating topic. This is a topic which is often swept under the rug, and we have the opportunity as we move towards Beshalach. This really links us from the book of Bereshis to the book of Shmos. This is the topic of the bones of Yosef. It appears a number of times. What we're going to do is we're going to start off at the very beginning, and we'll move our way through to try to appreciate some of the fine aspects, the nuances of this fascinating topic. We're told an interesting thing. We're going to first follow through the psukim themselves, then we'll look at some midrashim, and then drive deeper into some more holistic perspectives, political, psychological perspectives, and trying to understand this very interesting moment in history. So we know that actually at the very, very tail end, the tail end of Sefer Bereshis closes almost anticlimatically. We think about Bereshis as we're moving towards this crescendo. We have the brachos of Yaakov. Yaakov is buried. And the last thing that happens is this. We're told the following in the Torah Shebichsav, in the first source. This is Bereshis Perek Nun. Vayomer Yosef el Echov, Anochi meis, ve'elokim pakod yifkod eschem, ve'elo eschem min ha'aretz azois. Look, Hashem's going to take you out of the land of Israel, the land of Egypt, to the land which was sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Hashem is going to redeem you, and you're going to take my bones out with you. He died. He was embalmed, and he was placed in a casket in a Aaron in Egypt. This is the end of the story over here. Just so fascinating, before you even go any further, you see a fascinating psychological insight over here, which is a terrifying insight. And that is, if you were to say, what is the temperature of the relationship between the brothers and Yosef at this point in time? I would say so-so is a pretty good accurate. Lukewarm is the level of the relationship. Why? Because Yaakov, just passed away. And as you know, when a patriarch, a matriarch of the family disappears and there's already tension in the family, that's the moment where increased tension is likely to happen, because the patriarch or the matriarch was holding everything together. Now that disappears, the glue, so to speak, disappears. And then there's tension. And we saw that tension already, because just previously the brothers of Yosef said to him, Yaakov Avinu actually made a promise that you shouldn't, and they were getting really up. They were getting concerned that Yosef might exercise his power to now exact from them revenge. So we know that they're very uncomfortable about what's going on. So if that's the case, what is fascinating is that what Rav Soloveitchik points out just over here, without even going any further, without even getting to the burial of Yosef later on, is Yosef did the counterintuitive action over here to fix things. And that is, he made himself absolutely 100% vulnerable to his brothers. Because, his last executive wish should have been something he gave to those he trusts the most. But the people who don't trust him enough to look after them are the last people you'd think that he would give over the burial power, the execution of his burial. But by doing that, by making himself absolutely vulnerable in a situation where he himself will not be able to have even a negotiation at that point in time, what he's saying is that I trust you enough, therefore trust me enough. His last action was actually an action of peace. Just if you think about that, that's a very, very powerful statement. A statement which I don't think most people are capable of making. That's a very, very powerful idea about how to create peace, is through vulnerability, by daring greatly sometimes. This is the first level of what we know about. And the next part is actually where we see the fulfillment of this, actually, at least in the Psukim, which appears the next step, where in Parshas B'Shalach, which is where we're heading, we're told the following. Vayikach Moshe es atzmos Yosef, imoy. And Moshe Rabbeinu takes the bones of Yosef, saying, Ki ashbeh ashbeh es b'nei Yisrael emor, pokod yivkod elokim eschem, alisem es atzmos amizeh etchem. Moshe Rabbeinu acknowledges, he nods to that requirement that Shavua made by B'nai Yisrael on behalf of Yosef, and he now takes them up. We have to think to ourselves, you know, why was Moshe Rabbeinu in this point in time the agent of this? Why was Moshe Rabbeinu specifically the person who was there was nobody else who was in charge of taking the bones of Yosef at this critical moment? You know, everybody else at this point in time is taking selfies at the Egyptian Oval Desk. You know, everybody else at this point in time is busy taking off the chandeliers of their neighbors. And Moshe Rabbeinu is busy searching around for the bones of Yosef. Why was it Moshe's responsibility out of anybody else?
Well,
ask the Medrash. The Medrash addresses specifically this and says because Moshe Rabbeinu was looking for mitzvahs, but there's more to it than that as well. But it's fascinating, just a fascinating thing. There's such a critical moment, and there's Moshe Rabbeinu. He's, you know, scrambling to get the bones of Yosef at this point in time as he's leaving.
He knows they'll trigger Yamsuf and he needs it for the Yamsuf.
The possibility. let's at this point in time just appreciate the questions before the answers. So there are a number of questions we haven't got to yet. But last point is the third time they emerge, and this is where most people don't know because, of course, it's in Nach. Torah we got, right? We got Torah. That's what we're learning. But the Nach part is where it's important to be able to learning. Push, hint. Let's learn Nach, right? So in Sefer Yehoshua, this is where it says, at the very tail end of Sefer Yehoshua, Perek Chav Dalet, that everything is being wrapped up. We know Yehoshua passes away. We're told at the end of the Sefer, Vayihi acharei advarim o'ele v'yomos Yehoshua ben Nun, Eved Hashem ben Me'a v'esar shanim. Yehoshua dies. He dies at the age of 110. He was buried in Shechem in the plot of land which was bought by Yaakov. There were three parts of land that were ever bought by Hebrews, by Israelites in the land of Israel. And they were Shechem, Hebron, and Yerushalayim. The three parts which we actually paid for and we invested in to make sure that there would be unilateral, that we had rights to, are the three most contested areas in Israel today. But nonetheless, right, that seems that everybody else jumped on the bandwagon after Yaakov and Moshe and David, and Avram and David actually made the acquisition, and that's where he's buried in Shechem. Very interesting point to notice over here is that it only describes the burial, the ultimate, we'll call it, fulfillment of the promise of Yosef at the end of the book of Yehoshua, which is at least 28 years after when they entered the land of Israel. So now, Muslim Mepharshim suggests that clearly Yosef was buried before then. Right, it wasn't that they were waiting to the death of Yehoshua to bury the bones of Yosef, but somehow it is aligning the death and the burial of Yehoshua with the burial of Yosef, even though that may have occurred earlier, which is fascinating. So let's just stop and ask a few basic questions. Now that these are the full gamut of the expression in Torah Shebichsav, at least explicitly. So the first question is why Yosef out of everybody else? Meaning that actually the Medrash does make the diuk. It does make notice that when Yosef says itchem, with you, that the Midrash says that means your bones as well. All the Shvatim will also carry, but Yosef is the one who is identified as being, so to speak, the leader of the group. Yosef is always seen as the leader of this delegation. So why was it Yosef? Maybe he was the one who had initiative, maybe it was the one who had the political clout to be able to demand this in the first place, but at the same time, he did not tell them to do it now. He didn't believe that perhaps his brothers had sufficient reach to be able to do it like he did for his father. He was not able to do it necessarily right now. That is a question. Also, why was this? You know, it really does seem anticlimactic to end the Sefer Bereishis with this. This, you know, it happens to be a detail. It is important and part of Jewish history, and it's very important to know where Yosef is buried, even though it's one of the most contested territories, which has attacked, you know, numerous times over the last few decades because of the lack of basic human dignity and respect in the Palestinian camp. And this is one of the Oslo agreements, right? But why is it that Sefer Bereishis had to end? Why did Sefer Bereishis have to end on this moment? This is how Sefer Bereishis ends, Yosef's request. Yosef dies and we enter this. And more than that, why specifically the bones as well? You know, he could say, take me up, right? When you think about yourself, when you talk about your last will and testament, you don't talk about your bones, you talk about yourself. Right? So why specifically his bones? A lot of interesting questions. A few things to notice over here. One of my teachers is by the name of Rabbi Chaim Angel, who's a person who really enlightened my perspective in Nachi Nevi'im and Ksuvim, a really remarkable individual. If anybody has the opportunity of having the opportunity to hear him, he used to be the rabbi in the Spanish Portuguese shul before Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik. Very, very fine individual who teaches Nevi'im and Ksuvim at Yeshiva University. I had the opportunity of going to many of his classes and then auditing years afterwards as well. Through his perspective, and he says he has an essay on this particular topic. Actually, I heard it as a shir beforehand. He makes a lot of very interesting points. Just want to identify a few of them, and then perhaps we'll go even further afield. So, first point is over here is that Yosef is a unique individual in that Yosef is an individual who never received prophecy explicitly. If you think about that, throughout Yosef's life, you never have an encounter of the Ribbono Shel Olam, of the Almighty, ever speaking to Yosef, but Yosef is an individual who lives with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the most explicit and extreme way, more than anybody else you really meet. If you think about it, he is the non-prophet servant of God. Think about all the experiences of Yosef. He's walking down to Shechem, there HaKadosh Baruch Hu is very gently leading him towards his destiny through the angel. When Yosef is asked about his dreams, he says, Biladai Elokim Yaneh Shalom Paro. It's not me, it's God. The God who threw him down to Egypt, the God who sold him down the river, right? That he's still. Then when his brothers came, he says, "No." He says, "Yeah, Hakadosh Baruch Hu sent me kilimichiyah shlochani elokim lifnechem." Hakadosh Baruch Hu sent you as a way to be able to sustain the known world. He was the man who had such a tangible sense of godliness when God never actually explicitly spoke to him. What a remarkable person! In a certain sense, by the way, Yosef, we are more akin to Yosef than any other than the Nevi'im. Yosef wasn't the Yirmiyahu, the Yeshayahu, the Moshe Rabbeinu, who had HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling him what to do all the time. Yosef was an individual who had to make very human decisions in very dark places, and he still felt the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu surrounding him and ensconcing him. That's who Yosef was. So when you think about the uniqueness of Yosef and what his bones mean, what he represents, let's try to put this in perspective as a paradigm of an individual we can directly connect with. Many times we feel like Yosef, but many times do we talk like Yosef is the challenge that we have to be thinking about. Moreover, let's think about Yosef in terms of actually a parallel to Moshe and Yehoshua for a second. Yosef was an individual who brought Bnei Yisrael down to Mitzrayim. Moshe Rabbeinu was the individual who led Bnei Yisrael back out of Mitzrayim towards the land of Israel. If you think about the parallel of leadership, Yosef was the leader of the nation of the Israelites, of the Hebrews at that time. Moshe Rabbeinu was the leader of the Israelites as well, first as tribes and then as a nation. They're moving in the opposite directions, which is why it's interesting that Moshe Rabbeinu takes the role of bringing back the bones of Yosef. It's almost as if he takes the position that Yosef had. Yosef was the leader. Moshe is the leader. He takes that role. But Moshe Rabbeinu does not get fully there. He's not able to fully encapsulate the actual promise of Yosef because he doesn't get into the land of Israel. It has to be taken over by his student, who is Yehoshua, who comes from the tribe of Ephraim, who's a direct descendant of Yosef. Mm-hmm. It's also another fascinating thing. I'm sure you notice this. How many people in Tanakh die at the age of 110 years? Only two, and they are Yosef and Yehoshua. Maybe what Tanakh is telling us as well, in a certain sense, is the fulfillment of the experience of Yehoshua as an individual was to be seen upon the burial of Yosef's bones. He was seen as the scion, almost the continuation, the Makib HaPatish, of the journey of Yosef, who went down to Mitzrayim. That was the beginning of the Bris Ben Abasarim, fulfilled by Moshe coming up, and ultimately it was Yosef's scion himself, Yehoshua, who finishes that job. Just to put things into a bigger and a fuller perspective over here as well. You see something else. These are two basic ideas. Well, this is, yes, that's right. Our angel says it's just a very beautiful idea. One further idea just to notice over here, and perhaps there's just so many different angles to take it. I want to just think which way we should go right first. So, okay. So here is another reason as well to think about this. I like to actually go in to dip into the words. Actually, Dr. Yeager has an essay on this, which he sent me a number of years ago. I did not forget. I read it over. It was fantastic on this particular topic. And so I'd like to address some of the ideas, Bekitzer, that Dr. Yeager addresses on this topic. and then move this into the next step. So one or two other, let's stop here and appreciate just what we have over here. We have these three mentions in Tanakh. It was fascinating perspective. Dr. Yeager points out a very interesting thing, and that is that there is a medrash which says that when Moshe Rabbe, when Yosef was in Parshas Vayechi, it wasn't simply that he was talking about his own afterlife, so to speak. He also related to his father. At the beginning of the parasha, Yaakov says a very similar thing. Yaakov says, "I'll not take Bereini b'Mitzrayim. Don't bury me in Egypt." And Yosef says, "Anochi eseh kidvorecha. I'll do what you say." So what typically we translate that to mean is, "Anochi eseh kidvorecha" means, "I will take you and I will bury you in the land of Canaan." And that's what he did. But the Midrash says, "Anochi eseh kidvorecha," I will do what you just did, which means, like you asked to be buried in the land of Canaan, I will ask to be buried in the land of Canaan. Which seems a little strange because it seems a little self-serving at this point in time. Yaakov is talking about his last will and testament, and Yosef says, "You know what? I'll do the same thing." It's like, no, that's not the conversation. That conversation will happen later, Yosef. Not now. Now we're focusing on Yaakov Avinu. Why is Yosef, in a certain sense, extending the request of Yaakov and extrapolating it to himself? So, fascinatingly enough, there's a very interesting metaphysical, a spiritual idea, which is that when a child is formed, when a child is created, a child, the Midrash says that now this is clearly not a physical description, but a metaphysical description. The bones, the we'll call the skeletal structure, are contributed by the father, and the muscles, the flesh, are contributed by the mother. Which is, by the way, just why it is that when we daven for a chole or we daven for a niftar, we use different names, right? We daven when a person is still in life, we daven for ex ben mother. When a person passes away, ex ben father. Right, because the flesh disappears after death. When we're davening for health, we're referring to the flesh, the organs that should be healed after death. It's the father. This is not about genders and patriarchal society. This is about spiritual undercurrents. It's important not to play games with things we don't understand. It's like the first year physics major sort of opening up the flap and saying, "I'll play with." No, don't touch that. I need to understand the real physics behind here. So there's a lot to understand about this. So he says, in that sense, what's Yaakov Avinu saying? Yaakov Avinu says, "I cannot be buried in Mitzrayim." There's actually two components to his wish. One is not to be buried in Mitzrayim. The other one is to be buried in the land of Canaan. Both are important. One is he does not want to be buried in a place where either you'll be served or because the land itself will turn into lice later on, as the Mefarshim explain. But if that's true, then Yaakov's ultimate wish means to say everything that he created, so to speak, everything that came from him, should also not be buried in the land of Mitzrayim. And what's the direct creation of Yaakov in terms of the contribution of Yosef is? The bones of Yosef. Right? The bones of Yosef. Which means, as a direct extension of what you just requested, O Yaakov Avinu, O Father, is that I also should have my bones removed from the land of Canaan. Of Mitzrayim to the land of Canaan, because that's what you just asked for. Which is why it's itchem, which is why it's with the rest of the brothers as well, because they were also part of that expression of Yaakov Avinu. Think about that for a moment. The fullest expression of Yaakov, of the patriarch's wishes, are to be found in the extension of their transference of burial as well with Yosef. That's the ultimate expression of this, which means this leads us to a very fascinating conclusion then. This is what the Midrash says. This is to be understood in this way. Now, let's take it one step further. This is the Midrash as explained by the Emunah Sitecha Rav Wolfson at the end of Parashas Vayechi. Now, let's take this one step further. It says there's a very fascinating Midrash which we're going to try to interpret on a number of levels. And this Midrash is to be found on the next page, on page three. We're told in source 6, Vayayom ra'a vayanos hayadein yisov le'achar. That the sea saw, and fled. That's where the expression comes from, naturally. And what was it that the sea saw specifically? The Midrash says in the Tanchum, in the next source, it says it saw the Arona Shel Yosef. It saw the bones, the coffin of Yosef, and that's what made it move backwards, so to speak. So, what was it about the bones of Yosef? So the argument is the following, and it's much longer. I'm going to just summarize this point, Dr. Yeager, for this point, is that you see an interesting thing happen, and that is that when the Bnei Yisrael reached the sea at Kriyas Yamsof, suddenly we have a castigation. Suddenly we have actually B'nai Yisrael put in the defendant dock, as the angels say, Halalu Avdei Avodah Zarah, Halalu Avdei Avodah Zarah. How much better are they than the rest of the folks chasing them? Why should they have any merit to go through the sea? That the angels couldn't have asked this any time earlier in their existence. B'nai Yisrael didn't have, you know, suddenly now it happens. The answer is because up till now, B'nai Yisrael was somewhat, you know, they were in their ghetto. They lived together. They were the underdog together. They suffered together, these Hebrews. And therefore, they in a certain sense, they spoke the same dialect. They were united. And as long as your nation is united, when it comes to all the problems they had in society, their Avodah Zarah, all their cultural issues, they were still protected. When they came to Yamsuf, with their backs to the water and Egypt in front of them, desert on either sides, that's when you see factionalization starting to happen. Where the Gemara sort of describes that one group says, you know, let's fight, one group says, let's run, one group says, let's daven. Everybody starts fighting. The moment you start fighting, then it's paradah ha-chavila, then everything falls apart. All the castigation, all the critiques on them up till now suddenly are open. The doors are open because you're no longer banding together. What did it take for them to get through the sea? What did the sea saw? It saw the bones of Yosef. What was Yosef? Yosef was ultimately the uniting factor between all the brothers of Yosef. He was the one who said, you know, Yaakovinu asked us to be able to take his bones and all his progeny to the land of Canaan. The only way to do this is if we do this together, itchem. Only through that was the sea able to split, because only through that was the defense offered. Fascinating perspective in terms of that. I thank Dr. Yeager for a very, very valuable insight. Let's take it to the next a fair. We didn't get to the Mishnah Chochma there. We were as close as we could possibly. Okay, there we go. Let's take it one step further. This is one level of it. Let's take it one step further in a different direction. If we actually read that Midrash Tanchuma, which is in Source 7, which talks about the sea seeing and splitting, you see something very fascinating which happens. This is actually the Tanchuma is describing the episode with Yosef and his encounter with Mrs. Potiphar. It says, she grabs his coat and he runs outside. Kofatz b'skus avois. He jumped up because of his parents, his parentage. Heach, mordat omar vayotze osa chutza. Shimon is kitron omar b'skus atzmoisa shil Yosef nikra yom li Yisrael. Shimon, the man of Kitron, would say the following: because of the schus of Yosef, the sea split. The sea saw and it split. Because it says that he left his garment in her hands and he fled. What's the Midrash picking up on here? What does the Midrash notice in the text of the Torah? It's the same word. Right? Hayom ro'o vayanos. And it says vayanos achutza. Which means there's a parallel. It's not simply, you know, that these episodes, you know, that Yosef himself, as a person, as an individual, it was something about the specific action when he was able to defy the Ashes Potiphar, which was allowed the sea to split. That's very strange. Like, what, you know, besides the word parallel, what ideological parallel does there exist over here? So this goes back to a very fascinating discussion, something I came across a number of years ago when I was reading a book called Authentic Happiness. This is by Dr. Martin Seligman, for those people who are interested. He wrote a rejoinder later on called Flourish, which one should read them in order, first of Authentic Happiness and then Flourish. But it's a very fascinating developer. He's the founding father of positive psychology. So in this field, he describes this is not self-help books. This is research-based positive psychology. This is using research to be able to actually say what makes it better for us in life. And so he has a very interesting argument. He says, if you look at the first inaugural address of Abraham Lincoln, this is in March 4th, 1864. Okay, so you can actually see there's a picture of it. You can see that they were still constructing Congress at this point, and the buildings were still not yet fully constructed. At the very closing moment of his inaugural address, and remember, this is a moment of great tension. At this point in time, the Civil War is almost imminent. I apologize. My dating. I apologize. He's speaking afterwards. Let's not get confused with Gettysburg. You're right. He now, at this point in time, unfortunately too close to the end of his tenure, is now trying to address a fragmented nation. A nation which ultimately has gone through a terrible, terrible trauma and is still in the pangs of separation, still in the pangs of loss. And he says the following, I'm loath to cut close. We are not enemies, but friends, speaking to all Americans. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained it, must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grieve to every living heart and grave, I apologize, every grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over the broad, and it's an accent issue, will yet swell. He had an accent. Will yet swell the chorus of the union when again touched, as surely as it will be, by the better angels of our nature. So it's fascinating, is that, what is he appealing to? He's trying to tell American people, now's the time to drop the swords, to put away the guns, now's time to invest together. So what does he appeal to? What element of the human being? He calls to the better angels of our nature. I mean, say, in our character, we all are good. At heart, we're all good people. Try to be better. Try to make good decisions which are going to reflect that goodness in character. What's fascinating is that this speech would never have been able to be received as, by the way, Gettysburg, in terms of the idea of sacrifice today. Gettysburg would never go over today. To go to the Lincoln Memorial, read Gettysburg, and realize why the ideas of war and sacrifice are no longer ideas which people relate to. You turn to the left, that's Gettysburg. But when you think about this speech as well, this idea of appealing to the better angels of nature also became something which became a challenge for later generations to appreciate. Why? Because, you see, what happened was that this was in the space in time in history we believed in what was called character ethics. People were good because of good character, and people were bad, we'll call it negative angels of nature. They were bad because of bad things within them. The problem is that as history progressed, and so let's say as we move a little bit later, not too much further later in history, the Haymarket Square protests, in which the underprivileged were protesting, there was killing of a number of people in these protests, people started noticing interesting things, and that is that a lot of the people who are protesting were all underprivileged people who worked 16 hours in a mine, people who worked with no benefits. And people started wondering, maybe it isn't because they're bad people, but because they live in bad circumstances, which is a movement away from what's called character ethics, and movement more in a certain sense to the idea of nature, the socioeconomic background of individuals. Why is these people are displeased? Why is the people are fighting? The answer is they weren't given a fair opportunity. It wasn't the nobles, it wasn't the upper class, it wasn't the bourgeois who were fighting. These are people who had no better opportunity. And in fact, this became the predominant theme of the day as we moved into the 20th century, whether it be through Darwinism, Darwin thinking, through Marxism, which essentially argued that the people who are being treated the lowest echelons of Russian society and world society aren't bad people. They're people who never had an opportunity to do better. They are the pawns of the nobles. They are the pawns of the upper class. The movement was away from the idea of character, bad people being bad characters, but rather bad people being people with underprivileged circumstances. And this has been the predominant theme, in a certain sense, moving away from character ethics, throughout the 20th century, if you think about it. To the point where, you know, when you read, as an example, like Freakonomics and Super Freakonomics, the argument is, and it's been substantiated by statistics, that an underprivileged black child who would be given the same opportunities as a white child in this country would perform exactly the same. Right? I mean, you say there's a difference in the circumstances that they were given, and therefore there is nothing innate. It is simply the circumstances, the socioeconomic circumstances, which allow, unfortunately, or which predicate such a life of many, many, many to end up on the street, unfortunately, because the opportunities were never afforded. And that's been a predominant view of psychology. However, one bastion of character ethics has remained, and that's what's called personality ethics. Personality is where it's not prescriptive that people are good and bad, but rather that there are people who have the opportunity in a certain sense, because there has to be a mean between the two of these. On the one hand, if you talk about character ethics, and therefore everybody is good or bad, and bad people make bad decisions, and good people make good decisions, if you look at the other side where everybody is a function of the society that they're born into, then there's very little space for choices, and if you think about it, there's very little space for changes. Personality ethics is personality is the middle ground where you can say, no, you know what? People are so most certainly affected by impacted by their circumstances, But they actually can make choices. Not all the time. Sometimes the range of space for those choices, the spectrum is very limited to where they can make those choices. But the idea of positive psychology and where psychology is coming back to now is that, yes, socioeconomic background does inform a lot about our lives, but it doesn't dictate the ultimate end of our lives. We have the opportunity of making decisions, even though they might be smaller decisions, as to where we stand. Very fascinating history, and I recommend reading the more sophisticated expression of this in the actual book itself. But if you think about this for a moment, what's being described over here by Yosef and the sea is precisely this issue. If you think about it for a moment, you know, here you have masculine man in faraway country, rejected by parents, rejected by siblings for all ostensible reasons. He has now risen from the pit of the slave to being the second in command of the house of this individual. And this wife does not have attention from her husband, it seems. And there's no one else in the world who will hold him morally accountable to this action. What in the world is stopping him? What in the world is stopping him, unfortunately? People have less excuses today, God forbid. What happens? Vayonos hachutza. Yosef, in a certain sense, broke all surrounding economic, socioeconomic, all psychological reasons that a person would have been under those circumstances. He said, you know what, I'm not going to fall prey to my circumstances. I'm not going to be a victim of where I am. I am going to, in a certain sense, yes, if you were to plot the trajectory of this stone as it arcs its way through the air, you would say it would land on spot X on the ground. I am not going to land on spot X. I'm going to divert my life. I'm going to make a decision, even when I can't have a conversation anymore with this woman. I'm not able to have a conversation because I'm too in her control at this point in time. I'm not able to have that conversation. I will pivot myself outwards, even though it will incriminate me, because leaving your garment inside is a smoking gun, folks. Right? I will pivot myself ever so slightly that I'll land in spot Y. That decision of a person, in a certain sense, stepping outside of their nature, is the most remarkable endowment of the human being, which is called free will. And if you are able to overcome your nature, says the Midrash, then you know what? Even nature can overcome its nature. That's how the sea works. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says there's going to be a moment in time in history where I'm going to allow nature to defy its rules. Only if you can show me that you can defy your rules. That's why it says in the morning, it returned, the sea returned, la'esonoi, right? The Chazal tell us, what's la'esonoi? It's the same words as litnai'oi, to its precondition. I made wormholes. I made exceptions in nature, if human beings are able to show exception. That is what happened over here. That is what happened in the circumstance, and that's what the Midrash seems to be pointing to. What a powerful insight into human nature, which is being described in Yosef over here. It's not his life specifically, it's this moment, this critical moment, which all his life led up to, and ultimately remains as his legacy. One step further as well, and that is a very, very fascinating other Midrash, which describes Yosef as well. Midrash describes the following. This is to be found in Sota in the Talmud Bavli. It's actually Yud Gimel Amud Aleph to Amud Beis. Left out that in the notation. And source 9. It says, "Uchol oison shanim shayu Yisrael b'midbar, hayu shnei aronos halalu, echod shel meis ve'echod shel shchina mahalchim zeim ze." There were two arons in the midbar. There was the aron, the coffin of Yosef. And there was the Aaron, there was the Ark of the Covenant, and they would actually move together. Where did they keep the bones of Yosef? Proximate to the Aaron Shel Shechina. V'hayu oivrim v'shavim omrim, and people would say, Ma tivon shel shnei aronos halalu? What's in them? Omru, they responded, Echad shel meis ve'echad shel shechina. One is of the deceased, and one is of the living, divine presence. V'chi ma daiko shel meis lahalech im ha-shechina. And they said, what's the connection between the two? Amru kiyem zeh, mashakosu bazeh. This one fulfilled what is in that one. What is found in this chest is what is fulfilled in that chest. This human being lived the life as expressed in that. Very powerful description over here on so many levels. So you see here just a few interesting things. This obviously could be related to the previous point, but a few fascinating points to notice over here. I'd like to, for this moment, actually to relate to the writings of a very interesting individual whose later name in life was Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel. Anybody ever heard of the name? Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel. very interesting individual. I actually put his biography at the bottom over here, Adam Mizrahi. He was a very well-known Rav in Europe, and he made his way to Israel, and he actually changed his name. His name, Amiel, is actually a Hebrew rendition of the drashos that he wrote later on, which are drashos el ami, to my people. You can actually find them online. It's really worthwhile. There's three volumes of drashot el ami, and Amiel is the reversal of those words. Very, very fascinating person. He actually was, I believe, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and he was the predecessor of Rav Lau. When Rav Lau first came and he became the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, actually when he was here in our shul, and the Dvar Torah gave at Shtud HaShlishis, for those who remember, it was a year and a half ago, he actually quoted Rav Amiel. So that was where he sources from his predecessor as a chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Very fascinating individual, a person rooted in the wellsprings of the Torah of Eastern Europe, and also a person who clearly saw what was happening in Israel as the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Very a unique individual in his perspective, and he was a tremendous Talmid Chacham, at the same time also an appreciator of the complexities of the establishment of the State of Israel. Very interesting person. So he says he has a drasha on the last day of Pesach. This is in the second volume. It's drasha Yud Ches. And it's really worthwhile reading. It's very beautiful, beautiful Hebrew, beautiful ideas. And he talks about this particular medrash. And he says, this is the complement of the upest or the highest level, if you think about this. Why should it be that Yosef's bones are with the Aaron of the Shekhinah? What does that mean? Like, you know, okay, they're fulfilling his command, they're doing his wish, but with the Aaron, nobody was able to go there. Why is that? Here's what he says in the Drasha in Source 10. He says, Atzomos Halalu. We're starting in 10, we're actually starting the third paragraph down. By the way, on the right here, I put the stamp in Israel, which has his face on it, one of the stamps which has Rav Amiel's picture on it. And he's on the third paragraph on page 4, he says, Ha'atzomos Halalu. His kiram lohem es atzavao ha'achronoi shalai, pakoid yivkoid elokim eschem, vali semes atzmo sami zeitchem. It reminded them, he didn't just ask about being taken out. What did he ask? What did he say to them? He says, you will be taken out. Pakoid yivkoid elokim eschem. The addendum was, take my bones. Let's not forget the first part of the statement, is Hashem will redeem you. Kol kach gedola bekirboya ava la'aretz. He loved Israel so dearly and so deeply. V'kol kach hoya bitchonoi chazak shepokod yivkod elokim. And he trusted that Hashem would take them out. He trusted that Hashem would take them out. That's how deep it was. Ha'atzoma salado on the top of the next page. Hoyu ba'adam semel habitachon. They were a representation of trust. Ke aloi elu hein ha'atzoma shel Yosef. These are the bones of Yosef. Zewa eved. He was a person who was not embarrassed of his origins, of where he came from as an Ivri. And he never lost his trust in Hashem. He never lost that sense of self. To the point that nobody moved an arm or leg without his permission in the land of Egypt. He never lost his sense of identity. When they looked at Yosef, they looked at his legacy, they remembered something. They remembered the halacha. Shegam lamrois hanachashim v'akravim. Despite all the snakes and scorpions along the way. Lamrois ha'avni negev etzirei michshal. Despite all the vicissitudes of traveling through the desert. Yagil sof sof lematarasam. They will come to their destination. V'im ki amidbar aroich ma'oid. V'ein sham derech v'ein mesila. There's no plotted territory through the desert. Hinei. Alohen lil pol birucham. They should not give up hope. Ki sof sof yavoi ketz hapalait haflois. They will become the ends. Ukashikaf aleim amachso v'rabu atzahat zoakim v'omrim nafsheni v'esha ein kol. And when there will be moments in time where they say we have nothing to eat, we can't succeed. Oz heru lohem eshnei aronos alalo. They brought out both of these aronos. They brought out both of these arks. Umiyad nibdmu haruchos nirgu halavovos v'yodu ki oid lo avda tikvosam. And they remembered that we have a destination. They remembered that ultimately our hope is not lost. Yosef represented the person who died dreaming. He was the person who lived a life of such complexity, but he still succeeded and never lost his identity. He was the person who reminded them and he reminded us that ultimately we are going towards an ultimate redemption. It's fascinating. Rav Amiel goes further because this is a longer drasha. It's on the last day of Pesach. What's on the last day of Pesach?
It's the
Yizkor as well. It's the Yam Suf splitting was the seventh day. Eighth day is Yizkor and Chutz La'aretz. And he puts it all together in the Achron Shel Pesach, which is all together in Eretz Yisrael. And he says, how does this relate to Yizkor? He says, if you think about this for a moment, he says, for many people who, Rachman Litzon, we should not be in that situation, but many of us have had to bury people in our lives, loved ones in our lives. And in a certain sense, it feels very final. We leave them in the cemetery. And he says, but we don't leave them in the cemetery. We take out of the darkest of times their Aron. We take out their Aron, which goes to the Aron of the Shechinah. Remember the life that they lived and they continue to live. The hopes, the fears, the ideas that they represented, and that escorts us through our lives, through all the most complex of times, like the Aron of Yosef escorted them. It just reminds me of a number of writings over here. When I was looking at this, and I was looking at this drasha a number of years ago, I never had a chance to talk about it properly. But in Source 11, the To Be Forgotten, Thomas Hardy says, these are sped ancestry, lie here embraced. This is about the To Be Forgotten, that's the name of the poem. He's talking about being in a cemetery. He says, lie here embraced by deeper death than we, nor shape nor thought of theirs can you descry with keenest backward eye. They count as quite forgot, they are men who have existed not. Theirs is a lost past loss of fitful breath, it is the second death. What's the second death? Being forgotten. When he looks in a cemetery and he sees the rows and rows and rows of lives, of people who felt they were indispensable, and they're lying there in the quietness of time, he says, that's the second death. What this Midrash is saying, another sort of terrifying, Mitch Albom has a book called Have a Little Faith. Mitch Albom is more famous for? Tuesdays with Mari, folks, right? So in a book called Have a Little Faith, he says, this is just a very scary statement. The unvisited in nursing homes, the homeless found frozen in alleys, who mourn their passing, who mark their time on earth. Once on a trip in Russia, the Rebbe recalled, we found an old Orthodox synagogue. Inside there was an elderly man standing alone saying the morning's Kaddish. Being polite, we asked for whom he was saying it. He looked up and answered, I am saying it for myself. What Rav Amiel was saying is the blessing of the Atzamos Shel Yosef is that the bones leave. They're not left behind. The memory, the legacy, what they represented, the mission, the wishes, the aspiration, the fact that when he asked to be buried somewhere else, he told them, I trust in your redemption as much as I trust in my own redemption. I'm linking the two together. And therefore, at that moment, in 2,000 years later in history, where the Jews have not had sovereignty over any patch of land, where the Jews have been the worthless, the Jews have been at the heel of the boot of other nations, and finally, we remember that the bones of Yosef, which we took with us, with the Aron Shel Shechinah throughout, wherever it be in our Bate Midrashos and Bate Knesios, are still proclaiming the same message as Pakoid, Yivkoid, Elokim Eschem. And perhaps that's why it is that it is the last message. And this gives us one last insight, and that is what was the Shavuah? Who was the recipient of the Shavuah of Yosef's bones? Who was he Mashbia to take him out of Egypt? Who do you think? So it sounds like it's his brothers. Why was it Yosef, Moshe was the one who did it? Why was Moshe the caretaker of the bones of Yosef? Because ultimately, says Rabbeinu Bechaye, he was Mashpia, not just his brothers. He was Mashpia, all of Klal Yisrael. He says, my legacy is your responsibility. Your legacy, which I am representing, is your responsibility. This is the first time you have an intergenerational oath, which is binding on future generations. Think about that. This is the first time where another generation now bears responsibility and picks up from where the previous generation left off. Moshe Rabbeinu is the leader. He has to. Isn't that exactly the example of what the Aron Shel Shechinah is? We wake up, we're born as a Jew from our first memories. We're born into this. Did we choose? Did we ask? Did we beg? No! But the answer is, like the bones of Yosef, we are born into this yoke of responsibility, and that's the journey we take in life. And that's perhaps why it was so essential that the Bereshis ends with this as we lead to the next Aron, which is going to be the Aron Shel Shechinah, which is how Shmois ends when the Shechinah comes in. Just a fascinating perspective and why it's so crucial and why this is climactic and not anticlimactic. Thank you, Rabbi. So have a wonderful and meaningful day.